Lecture 3, The Roaring Twenties.
When we think of the 1920s today, we have sort of an image of the Roaring Twenties, women in flapper dresses, speakeasies, people out of the pages of an F. Scott Fitzgerald novel, silent movie stars, the arrival of the car, sort of glittering and dancing, and there's actually some truth in that image of the Roaring Twenties. But the starting point of the 1920s is actually a deep recession in 1920 and 1921. So deep, in fact, that it is sometimes referred to as a depression. It's not the Great Depression with a big D, of course, but it is a depression with a little d, and it's an event which is worth our attention. Why does the recession of 1920 and 21 take place? Well, like most big, sharp downturns in the economy, it has several different reasons. One, of course, is that there's a slowdown in government spending after World War I, and that slowdown in demand from the government helps cause the economy to slow down. Second of all, there's a slowdown in buying from abroad, because after all, after war, this is not a time when the poor, war-torn nations of Europe are going to be buying a whole lot of things from the United States as they were in the early years of the war. Moreover, though, it's often argued that one of the big causes of this slowdown was changes in Federal Reserve policy, as the newborn Federal Reserve struggled to get a grip on what a good, sensible policy would look like. During the war itself, the Federal Reserve had been trying to keep interest rates as low as it could, because it sort of viewed its effort in trying to help win the war was to let the government borrow money at low interest rates. So by keeping interest rates low, they were trying to keep down government interest payments. The difficulty was that toward the end of the war, the low, low interest rates meant that people were taking their gold out of the United States and investing it over in Europe, where the interest rates were somewhat higher. And legally, when a nation is on a gold standard, the Federal Reserve had to make sure there was a certain amount of, a minimum amount of gold in the vaults. And so they started raising interest rates in order to try and attract gold back or at least stop it from fleeing over to Europe. So interest rates start going up. They go up from about 4% in 1919 to about 7% in 1920. Now, we know today, and it comes as no shock, that higher interest rates also tend to slow down an economy. After all, when the interest rates are higher, people are discouraged from buying things like cars and houses, and businesses are less willing to borrow money in order to invest in new equipment. At the time, this point, although it's, you know, was understood by economists, was not really well understood in general discussion. And so raising these interest rates was thought of as a way of attracting gold back. It wasn't so clear that people realized this would deal quite such a blow to the economy. Banks were faced with a situation where they had been buying all these old government bonds during the war, bonds that paid a 4% rate of interest. Now the government was paying a 7% rate of interest. So a lot of the banks were trying to dump their old bonds and buy the new ones that paid the higher rate of interest. Those old bonds dropped and dropped and dropped in value since everyone was trying to get rid of them. And many banks, which had invested heavily in those bonds during the war, began to go broke. There were about 60 bank failures in 1919. That almost triples to 150 bank failures in 1920, and then more than triples to 500 bank failures in 1921. And of course, the combination of less buying power, fewer people paying back their loans, combined with dumping these old bonds, all really hit the banks hard. So you have a lack of credit in the economy, a lack of buying power in the economy. And notice that just as in the 1907 panic, problems in the banking system are multiplying the other problems that the economy has and causing them to be more severe. What happens as a consequence of this recession? Well, the economy shrinks. It falls 20%. Think of it. The economy shrinks 20% between 1919 and 1921. With no buying power, or very little buying power in the economy, the overall price level in the economy actually falls. Now, this is always a little odd for us to think about at the end of the century when we're used to an inflationary environment, but let's think for just a moment about what happens if you have deflation. What happens if the price level is dropping rather than rising? In particular, most people are familiar with the idea that if you borrow money at a fixed interest rate and then inflation comes in, you actually do pretty well because you can repay your loan in borrowed money in inflated dollars. And so you're actually better off. Anyone who bought a home at a low fixed interest rate, say in the 1960s or early 1970s, and then had inflation go way up, knows how you can really benefit from borrowing money in a time of inflation. Well, in a time of deflation, all that logic reverses itself. In a time of deflation, you borrowed a certain amount of money and you need to pay it back. But now, instead of money being worth less, dollars are becoming worth more and more and more and more. And so the burden of your loan is getting heavier and heavier and heavier. If you've borrowed a lot of money and the economy hits a time of deflation, you are in sad, sad shape because your wages and everything else are dropping and you need to be able to pay off the money that you borrowed earlier. Unemployment at this time gets up to about 10%, which is not calamitous, maybe. It's not like the Great Depression, but compared to the 1 or 2% unemployment during World War I, it's certainly not a very nice thing at all. One of the places this recession is felt most sharply is on America's farms. In fact, the early 20s you can think of as perhaps the true greatest crisis of American farming in this century. World War I was, in its own way, the final glory days of American farming. In fact, farmers used to actually refer to that period, 1910 to 1914, as the golden years. They're growing stuff, they're expanding markets, they can export things to Europe, prices are high. But they started investing in new technology, things like milking machines and tractors, better hybrid corn seeds, stuff like that. And after the war, Europe doesn't have the money to be buying food from the United States. Instead, they're rebuilding their own production. So the foreign markets are shrinking, productivity is going up and up, and the U.S. economy is in a recession, prices are dropping all over. Overall, consumer prices in 1920 alone dropped by 10%, but farm prices in 1920 dropped by 50%. That's how little demand there is once they've taken away the European demand and you've taken into account that they can produce so much at lower and lower costs. Since the crops are worth less and less, the farmland is also worth less and less because farmland produces less of value. And as a result, farmers are largely unable to pay off their capital investments. They are unable to pay the debt that they owe for the money they borrowed to buy land or the money they borrowed to buy tractors or milking machines. There are a huge number of foreclosures. During this decade, the overall U.S. population grows by 15%, but the population on the farm declines by 5%. So we're beginning to see a pattern which will go through the rest of the century, where people are leaving the farms and heading off for the cities. But a lot of that really kicks in during this 1920-21 recession. And we sometimes talk in our popular discourse today as if the problems of farmers really didn't start until the 1970s or the 1980s or something like that. But that's fundamentally wrong. Farm populations have had the same problem during most of this century, and it's just been going on and on. The difficulty is they keep producing more and more and more, and as they produce more and more and more at a cheaper and cheaper and cheaper level, you just need fewer farmers to supply the food for people. In effect, farmers are causing their own difficulties because the pressure of competition is leading to more and more and more productivity. That problem is especially apparent during the early 1920s, but it just continues on through the entire century. Fundamentally, I think the recession of 1920 and 21 is worth thinking about partly because you should be thinking about, if I were alive at this time, what would I be thinking about recessions? What's my view of what happens when the stock market crashes and the economy turns down? If I think about 1907 or I think about 1920 and 21, you think there's a certain pattern. There's a sharp contraction, things go down quickly, sure there's high unemployment for a year, but then the economy turns around. And after that, you can get relatively good growth that follows. Now, of course, there were some other minor recessions during these years that I really haven't paid much attention to. During the 20s, for example, there are minor recessions in 1923, 24, and in 27, 28. There's also a minor recession early in the 19-teens. But as you think about how people are reacting to the Great Depression and what you would have thought if you'd been alive during that time, it's important to remember that the pattern is quick decline, then rapid bounce back. And that's what people had in mind from their recent experience. That's what they would have been expecting to happen when the Great Depression comes along. What happens after the recession of 20 and 21? Well, after that time period, particularly by about 1923, we begin to get what we really think of as the Roaring Twenties, the consumption boom, the things coming to pass that had been building through the earlier part of the century. You have to remember that a certain amount of buying power had really been bottled up in the economy by World War I and the fact that you couldn't buy so many consumer goods during that time, and then by the recession itself. And so as the mid-1920s hit, this buying power, this new technology, it all kind of turns itself loose. So how does that change the lives of consumers? Well, one big way, thinking about electrification and that boom that we talked about, is that electrification begins to blend together with household appliances and change the way that people live. By 1910, you may remember, about 15% of homes were lit by electricity, and the rest largely by coal, oil, kerosene, and some natural gas. By 1920, 25% of homes are lit by electricity. And during the 1920s, it goes from 25% to 68%. So sort of broad electrification of many, many of the homes in the country happens over this time. By 1930, less than 1% of the homes are lit by coal, oil, or kerosene. There's still a number that are lit by gas, however. So it's basically two-thirds electricity and the remaining third are gas. Electricity unleashes a major shift in innovation and in new appliances. At the turn of the century, essentially no one has a refrigerator, a radio, a TV, a washing machine, a vacuum cleaner, an electric fan, a toaster, a stove. By the 1920s, mechanical refrigerators are entering the market, and about 8% of households have one by 1930. Washing machines go from single digits to a quarter of all households by 1930. Vacuum cleaners go from single digits to about a third of all households by 1930. Radios go from single digits to about 46% of households in 1930. In fact, there's one measurement that in 1924, one-third of all the money that households spent that year was spent on radios. There were hundreds of stations being formed, and a sense of kind of natural culture, of people listening to common things across broad horizons. There was a time when mass entertainment was on the rise, when movies, Major League Baseball, the 27 Yankees, those kinds of images were going across the country in a way that they really hadn't gone across the country before, and unifying the country in a certain way. All these new appliances and new ideas also changed the nature of what shopping was really like. There had been, of course, big department stores in the 19th century. Macy's in New York would be an example. But they didn't have branches that were scattered all over the place. In the 1920s, you get two firms that had really been mail order firms, Sears and Montgomery Ward, that had really just been sort of like L.L. Bean toward the end of the century. They did essentially all of their business by mail and by catalog. They begin to set up chains of stores. So Sears, for example, had 8 stores in 1925 and over 300 stores in 1929. Instead of opening up these stores in the downtown area where they would compete with something like Macy's, these stores are put out in more residential areas, off of big roads, in kind of open field areas where there's lots of room for parking around them. In fact, in the 1920s, you begin to see a few little shopping malls being formed around these stores, although the real shopping mall, as we would think of it today, doesn't kick in until after World War II. Of course, the automobile is essential here. The automobile is what lets people drive out to these stores and park. And the automobile truly arrives in the 1920s. In 1910, maybe 1% of all families have cars. By 1920, it's up to about a quarter of all families have cars. And by 1930, 60% of all families have cars. So the car has really spread broadly over the population. To put it another way, the number of people with cars expanded at 13% a year, 13% each year from 1917 up to 1929. The price of driving falls steadily. And while you could probably only drive about 30 miles an hour, remember that before this, you were really talking about walking or maybe taking a horse, or if it was a long trip, getting on a railroad. So there were enormous new vistas opened up of how to shop, like we talked about a moment ago, where to vacation, and where you could live. There's an enormous boom in residential construction, because now you can get out to these houses and drive off to where you work. You no longer have to live within walking distance of where you are. far. There had also, of course, been restrictions on building and stuff like that during World War I. So when those restrictions are lifted, you combine that with the car and the sort of pent-up demand, and an enormous number of houses are built. The number of miles of paved road double in the 1920s, and this doesn't even include 190,000 miles of federally supported intercity highways. During most of these years, the nation is spending maybe 2% of its economy just on road building. Today, if you multiplied that out, 2% of the modern economy would be like $150 billion a year just on building roads. Meanwhile, of course, transportation and public transportation is suffering. It's drifting down and down. Public transportation had been about 3% of a typical household income in 1910, or 3.6% in 1910, then 3% in 1920. By the end of the 20s, it's about 2%, and now the share of income spent on public transportation on average is less than 1%. Now, railroads complained about this, of course. They complained about the roads and this new competition. But after all, you have to remember the railroads had gotten these big land grants and had been protected by the military as they built across the country, so they were hardly in a position to say, we didn't get any government subsidies of their own. By the end of the 1920s, this is truly a huge industry. Remember, the auto industry barely exists at the turn of the century. They're these tiny little people mucking around in garages, really, making just a few little cars. By 1927, autos are the largest industry in the country. By the end of the 1920s, 1/8 of the nation's manufacturing output is cars. It employs 1/12 of all the manufacturing workers in the country. I mean, you think about that. It's an industry which doesn't exist and rises to that level of dominance within a period of 25 years. It also brought with it other industries. For example, petroleum production for gasoline. Petroleum production had already passed kerosene as the main way of generating fuel just before World War I. But under pressure from the car, new oil fields are opened up in Texas and Oklahoma and California, and new processes for producing the crude oil. These new processes literally get 3 times as much gasoline from a gallon of crude oil as they were getting before. Service stations are set up all over in order to fuel these cars as they drive around. So the topography of the nation is changed in a fundamental way. One final change for consumers, which is worth tossing in, is that the early 1920s is the birth of the AT&T monopoly. It's the birth of the telephone monopoly. It's the birth of Ma Bell, if you want to think of it in that way. In 1921, Congress passed the Graham Act, which officially exempted AT&T from the Sherman Antitrust Act. And this would act to protect AT&T from full competition until well into the 1980s. You did have long-distance coast-to-coast telephone service as far back as about 1915, but it's still true that people are communicating largely by telegraph. However, in 1920, long-distance telephone outstrips the telegraph, and the number of phone conversations doubles during the 1920s. Again, communications are tying the country together, transportation is tying the country together. And so in all these ways, consumers are living in a very different world than they did before. What's happening with government macroeconomic policy in this time? I think what you could really say is the government is beginning to understand macroeconomic policy in a different way. For example, there's a certain willingness to think about the Federal Reserve doing some of what we would now call today monetary policy. People noticed what happened during the recession of 20 and 21. They sort of said, okay, the Fed kept interest rates really low, and then it raised interest rates. And what happened? The economy went down the tubes. We can see the pattern here. We can see something that happened. We can see that the Federal Reserve has the power to adjust interest rates, and when it uses that power, it's going to affect the overall economy and whether it goes up or down. Remember, the Fed had just been getting started when it was interrupted by World War I. So this idea that you would be manipulating things in a peacetime context to try and make the economy go up and down is a new thought. It's a new development, really, in how we think about our power over the economy. Instead of just thinking the Fed is there to avoid a bank panic, we begin to think of it as a macroeconomic policy tool in a modern sense. As I mentioned a little bit ago, there are some weak recessions in the middle of the 1920s. There's one in 1923-24 and one in 27. Some thought that the reason these recessions were so weak was that the Fed had things figured out, that they had messed up and caused the recession in 1920-21, but that now that they had things figured out, we wouldn't need to worry about having recessions anymore. We'd figured out how monetary policy works, and we'd cured recessions. Now, of course, this arrogance looks from our modern point of view to be kind of almost hilarious. But I would say that, you know, this kind of arrogance is an arrogance that the U.S. goes through every few years. In the early 1960s, we thought we had it all figured out. We wouldn't have to have any more recessions. In the mid-1980s, you sometimes heard people saying, well, now we've got it all figured out. We're not going to have any more recessions. If history teaches us anything, it's that we will get more recessions and we won't be able to control them fully over time. And people who claim otherwise are probably just a little too optimistic. There is a reasonable argument that maybe we know enough to make current recessions less severe than those of 1920 and 21. But less severe doesn't mean they're going to go away altogether. My point here is not that the Fed actually did such a great job. There's actually a lot of controversy among economists as to whether they actually really knew what they were doing. My point is that the general broad theories and the willingness to act were there in the 1920s in something of a different way than they were before. A second thing that happens in terms of government is the government runs budget surpluses all the way through the 1920s. I think this is worth noting just because there isn't any other decade in the 20th century where the U.S. government runs a budget surplus every year all the way through the decade. The government starts off the 1920s about $24 billion in debt from having fought World War I. In today's dollars, of course, you'd have to multiply that by a factor of 10 or 15, but even so, it's not a huge amount of debt. But thanks to the growing economy and the fact that the government was shrinking back and still was getting all this money from the income tax, they ran a string of budget surpluses all through the decade. And by the end of the decade, debt is down to about $16 billion. So it had dropped by about a third. This is literally the only time in the 20th century when the government debt actually falls because there are surpluses the whole way through the decade. So it's worth noting for that reason. In terms of government policy, though, the most interesting policy experiment is probably on the supply side of the economy, as we would call it today. And these are the experiments carried out under the pressure from Andrew Mellon, the Secretary of the Treasury. Now, Mellon is remembered today, I think, for several different reasons. He was, of course, one of the great financiers of his time, with a sort of an ability to spot new industries and help develop them with financial assistance. He, for example, was behind the firms which turned into the Aluminum Company of America, Alcoa, and also what later became U.S. Steel. Those were companies that he funded through his bank that grew into real titans. Among the general public, I think many people have heard of the Mellon Foundation, which is, you know, money that was generated by Mellon's personal fortune. And also Mellon is the one who donated both the art and the money to build the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. For our purposes, what we care about with Andrew Mellon is that he was also the nation's longest-serving Secretary of the Treasury. He was appointed Secretary of the Treasury in 1921 by President Warren Harding and held the role all through the Coolidge presidency and under Hoover as well until he became ambassador to Great Britain in 1932. So he continued to be Secretary of the Treasury through three presidents, which is an interesting thing. Remember that during World War I, he inherited sky-high top tax brackets, you know, 77% and higher. And he thought they were just far too high and ought to be reduced. So in 1921, he argued and pushed through Congress something for reducing the top tax rate from about 65%, which is where it had been after the war, down to 50%. In testifying before Congress in 1923, he said, "Wealthy men will not pay on half of their income to their government. They just will not pay half of their income to their government. Therefore, it is better to tax them at a rate they will pay." And he argued for cutting the top tax rate down to 40%, actually. They gave him about half of that and cut it to 50%. But notice the argument here. The argument is not about stimulating the economy. The argument is about compliance with taxes, which is a slightly different thing. In 1926, he cut the top tax rate still further. Well, he cut it in 23, cut it again in 26. And so the top tax rate by the mid-20s is down in the range of about 30%. Now, interestingly, while his tax revenues dropped after the end of World War I, total tax revenue for the federal government stays about the same as a share of gross domestic product through the 1920s, from 1923 to 1929. So, lower tax rates were actually collecting as a share of the economy about the same amount during this time. How do you manage this trick? How do you manage this trick of cutting tax rates but collecting about the same amount? Well, one part, which Mellon had stressed in his congressional testimony, is that evading taxes isn't worth it as much if the tax rate is lower. When the tax rate is 70% or higher, rich people try and seek out ways of avoiding taxes. You know, they go around, they look for ways of investing in different places that won't be taxed. They hide money. They put it offshore. They put it into corporations. They do all kinds of tricky things to avoid having that be income to them that can be directly taxed. At a lower tax rate, a lot of that finagling isn't worth it anymore. And so you sort of call forth money which was out there, but, you know, wasn't going to be taxed because you just weren't going to be able to get to it. A second argument, though, was whether or not these tax rates actually stimulated the growth of the 1920s. If they did, you could make a supply-side argument that by stimulating that economic growth during the 1920s, the lower tax rates brought in more money, or at least an equivalent amount of money. And this is, of course, similar to arguments that will rage during the 1980s and 1990s about supply-side economics. In general, the argument in the 20s is very similar to the one in the 80s. Mellon is a good Republican saying cut taxes by a lot. The Democrats are sort of saying, well, we're also for cutting taxes, but not by quite as much, and we'd like to tax the rich a little bit more. And the argument and the tone of it is just very similar to what we have toward the end of the century. Now, how true is the supply side argument at the time? Let me phrase the question this way. How much of the growth of the 1920s happened because of Mellon's tax cuts for upper income taxpayers? Well, we've talked about what was behind the growth. It's the bounce out of World War I. It's the bounce out of the Depression from 1920 and 21. It's the booming of the automotive industry, the electrification of the economy, and all those things. It's the growing education base, which is going on through this time. And of course, you remember the Fed figures out what's going on a little bit and starts cutting interest rates to some extent to avoid recessions as well. Now, cutting taxes certainly helped a little bit. There's no question about that. But to say that they were the main factor behind the 1920s and that all those other things are relatively small factors, I think would just not be accurate. Certainly, it did help stimulate the economy some, but the overall bulk of what's going on is clearly all of these other kinds of factors. It's certainly true in the 1920s and today that taxes which are too high can be counterproductive because people will figure out ways to avoid paying them. But, you know, conversely, the overwhelming growth of the 1920s is coming from other factors, not from the tax cut itself. How do we think about the 1920s in terms of how it reshaped growth and conditions of labor, and whether or not those patterns of growth were things that could be sustained? From 1923 to 29, the real economy is growing 2% per year faster than population growth. Now, 2% per year may not sound like a whole lot, but think about it. 23 through 29 is 7 years. 2% per year means that only 5 or 6 years later, the average person was 15% better off in just 6 years. Now, 15% better off in 6 years is just not a trivial amount. That's really quite rapid, quite exceptional growth. And wages were growing rapidly. Consumption was growing rapidly as well. This led to a virtuous circle. The virtuous circle is the high demand led businesses to invest more and more and more. Their investment stimulated production more and more and more. This, of course, their investment could lead to higher productivity. And if you're working, you like it when your business invests more because that capital allows you to be more productive and allows you to earn higher wages. The theories of Frederick Taylor about how this is a positive-sum gain. Everybody can produce more. Everybody can consume more. Everybody can get higher wages seem to be coming true in some sense. In addition, though, this is probably a time when economic inequality is growing, because the people who can take advantage of a certain education level and get into the auto factory or into the factory where the electronics goods are being made have access to what at that time was the high technology of the time. And so although the statistics on income distribution are very, very sketchy for the 20s and 30s, it seems likely that we're seeing, based on what we do have, that there is an expanding income inequality during this time, based on the fact that some people can take advantage of the technology better than others. And of course, today, a lot of the reason for income inequality is probably that certain people can take advantage of today's new technology better than others, something we'll talk about later in these lectures.
What else is happening that affects labor during this time? Well, one big thing is limits on immigration are taking place. Limits on immigration have been kicked around for decades and implemented, you know, off and on and off and on all through the 19th and early 20th century. But in the end, it was often true that presidents vetoed the toughest of the anti-immigrant legislation. So, for example, Presidents Cleveland and Taft and Wilson had all vetoed fairly harsh anti-immigration bills. More serious limits on immigration are started during World War I, and in fact, Wilson vetoes these limits, but his veto is overridden by Congress. This is, of course, a time when, because it's wartime, fear of foreigners is running especially high. And what they do to limit immigration during World War I is pass a rule that immigrants pass a literacy test. And of course, if you're coming from a different culture and a culture where there's a lot of illiteracy in any language, passing a literacy test in English is fairly difficult. One of the big supporters of the anti-immigration bills are the labor organizations, like the American Federation of Labor, which fear that if you have more immigrants, it's going to hold down wages for low-skilled workers. Actually, this fear was kind of weird even at the time, because most union workers were not low-skilled workers. They were relatively medium or even high-skilled workers by the standards of the time, and they didn't have a lot to fear from immigrants. But they did fear the immigrants, and they were big supporters of these laws. In the early 1920s, in 21, 24, and 29, there are quotas set up to limit the amounts of immigration, which, after all, you have to remember, immigration could have been quite substantial in the 1920s, given that transportation is getting cheaper and cheaper, given that the economy is booming. Remember that about 26% of the American population was foreign-born in 1900. By 1920, that was already down to about 13% of the population. And by 1940, after these restrictions had really taken effect, and given that during the Depression, nobody wanted to come to the U.S. anyway, a foreign-born share of the population is down to like 11% of the population. So there's a transformation of where people are born. At the turn of the century, maybe a quarter are born somewhere else and had come here. And by the 1920s and the 1930s, we're getting down more toward 10%. It is a painful necessity to note that these anti-immigration laws were often straightforwardly racist laws. They completely banned, for example, immigration from the Far East, pretty much on racial grounds. They also allocated immigration slots to each country according to the share of people of that national origin already in the United States. So the idea was they were going to preserve the sort of racial and ethnic composition of the United States. They restricted labor from abroad heavily, and in that sense, they probably were a benefit to unskilled workers in the country during that time. When you think about what's happening during that time, the new factories, the new investment, if there had been a whole lot of unskilled workers flooding into the country to take those jobs, then investment wouldn't have been so attractive. There would have been low-skilled labor to work in the factories instead. And so the industrial development pattern of the U.S. might have looked a little bit different. We might have still grown quickly, but the focus might not have been as much on investment and electrification and those kinds of things as it turned out to be. There's also during this time, affecting the conditions of labor, a really broad expansion of education that's going on. Even in 1900, there were a number of states that had compulsory school attendance laws. But in the first couple decades of the century, they made these laws stricter. They actually began to enforce them, which was something of a change. Enrollment in high schools more than doubles from 1910 to 1920, and then it doubles again by 1930. But it's worth remembering that this rise meant that instead of about 10% of all adolescents having a high school degree, by the end of the 1920s, now about 30% of all adolescents have a high school degree. The opportunities in this new society, this new industrial boom, were in industry and in cities. And people were leaving the farms, heading for the cities, and using their high school educations in order to take jobs like bookkeepers and secretaries, and taking care of the administrative job of handling these large factories. Those people who were able to get those jobs, those high-educated people, were the ones who were doing really well and becoming sort of the new upper-middle class and rich in the society. Those who didn't get the additional education and didn't go on to the factories and the industries were those who weren't doing quite as well. Child labor is constricting. Remember that at the turn of the century, it was like 25% of all boys 10 to 15 were in the labor force. Now, by the end of the 1920s, there's some folks who work on the farm and are helping out around the farm. But child labor has really diminished down into single digits. The basic lesson here is really twofold. One is that education really is a substantial contributor to economic growth. It really does help higher wages. It really does develop an economy. But on the flip side, in certain environments, the great gains from education can combine with the great gains from new technology to create a situation where there is greater inequality in the economy as a whole, where those who get the higher education and can combine it with the new technology are going to be better off and a lot better off than those who don't. And so that kind of a combination of the education to take advantage of new technology is a story that we'll be talking about more in the 1990s as we talk about what happens at the end of the century. As we look across the economy, the conditions of labor and industry, one of the other big changes is that industry is becoming electrified. Industry is taking advantage of electricity, so it's not just households that are plugging in appliances, but industry rebuilding all of its plants. In 1919, 50%, about half of the power in manufacturing was from electricity, and the rest was still like water and steam and coal and things like that. By the end of the 1920s, it was up to 82% of all the power in manufacturing was from electricity. Now, electricity plants really look a lot different than plants that are run on water or steam or coal. You change the light, you change the air quality. You don't need to have big belts running across the ceiling that hook up all your equipment to the paddle wheel that's outside in the water stream. You begin to have all kinds of flexibility to move machinery around because you don't have to orient it toward your power source. If you're beside a river and that's your power, you've got to orient everything toward the river. If you're electrical, you can put your plant any place and you can plug different things in the walls and arrange them in whatever order seems best. So it took, of course, decades for this to work its way out. Decades for firms really to rebuild their entire physical plant to take advantage of these changes in electrification. But as they did that, they were able to take advantage of Taylor's ideas of scientific management and to sort of participate in an investment boom. And one final question about the economy at this time is the question about debt and speculation. A lot of people know there was a stock market boom during this time in the 1920s. It's not just a boom in the stock market, but there's also a lot more use of debt. Consumers begin to use installment debt, paying over time to buy all these cars, all their new appliances. Perhaps 2/3 of the sales that happen in the 20s are happening with borrowed money. This is before the days of truth in lending laws, so people are paying just sort of whatever they end up getting stuck paying. Interest rates above 30% are not uncommon during this time for consumers to have to pay. There's also a sharp increase in stock market trading. The number of shares traded on the New York Stock Exchange increases by 26% per year between 1923 and 1929. So it's going up 26% every year over that time. There are all sorts of financial industries that are spreading more and more. Banks, life insurance companies, savings and loans. As income goes up, there are more and more deposits. And they're lending out all that money for the new home construction, for the new business equipment, all those kinds of things. Measured by one stock index, the Standard & Poor's Index, the value of the stock market triples from 1923 to 1929. And of course, it goes down a little bit now and then, but every time it goes down, it seems to shoot right up again. There is a feeling of speculation and of expanding speculation. The 1920s, for example, are the time of one of the first Florida land booms, when all these northerners got free trips down to Florida. They would look at how beautiful and sunny it was, and then they would sign a contract for their very own little piece of paradise. When they actually got around to looking at the land, they tended to discover that it was actually underwater. All this debt, all this speculation is clearly helping to soup up the economy and put more buying power out there. Of course, the Great Depression raises the question of whether it may have gone too far, but we'll talk about that in the next lecture. What are some echoes that go from the high-tech 1920s to the high-tech 1990s? And I really do think you should think about them as the high-tech 1920s. It's a time when patterns of living are being transformed in major ways. One is that there is an inescapable link between economic growth and rising wages. That as growth goes up, wages are also going to go up. And you can't have a situation where you want wages to get higher and higher, but not be in favor of economic growth to do that. Why is that at a fundamental level? Well, at a fundamental level, wages represent about 2/3 of our economy. Now, imagine that what we were going to do was take the rest of the economy, the other third, which is profits and interest payments and things like that, and we were to start transferring that over to people who get wages. So wages would take a larger and larger share of the economy. Instead of taking 2/3 of the economy, they'd take 70%, then 75%, then 80%, then 85%. The problem is, eventually, wages would be taking 100% of the economy. And at that logical limit, you just can't expand wages anymore. So this notion that you could expand wages over time in perpetuity by taking from others is just not going to work out over time. You have to expand the size of the overall pie. Of course, there are other reasons not to just take all the profits from corporations. That's the money they use for investment. That's the money they use to build for future growth. So I'm not advocating that for a lot of different reasons. But the notion that redistribution from profits to wages will over time make everyone rich just runs into the difficulty that once you've seized all the profits, there isn't any more to seize. So if we want to have rising wages, one of the lessons of the 20s is we need to get more economic growth. Another lesson of the 1920s, I think, is that we should be cautious about assuming that change levels off. Remember, at the turn of the century, they pretty much thought they had done it all. They'd seen it all. They were on top of the world. In the 1920s, people also felt they'd done it all. They'd seen it all. They're on top of the world. And so in recent times, when we have a tendency sometimes to think, well, we've done it all. We've seen it all. We're on top of the world. We should have a little bit of skepticism. And I remember that people feel that way over and over and over every two or three decades, most of the century. In fact, at this time, one of the big concerns in the 1920s was that with all these new inventions, women in particular wouldn't have anything to do. Because after all their tasks were going to be taken up by this equipment. And even someone as smart and liberal as the eminent economist John Maynard Keynes could write in a 1930 essay that the real problem for society was that upper-class women had too much time on their hands. He said, to use the language of today, must we not expect a general nervous breakdown? We already have a little experience of what I mean, a nervous breakdown of the sort which is already common enough in England and the United States, amongst the wives of the well-to-do classes, unfortunate women, many of them, who have been deprived by their wealth of their traditional tasks and occupations, who cannot find it sufficiently amusing when deprived of the spur of economic necessity to cook and clean and mend, and yet are quite unable to find anything more amusing. And this notion that technology would have taken up all of our jobs, there wouldn't be anything left to do, we won't be able to think of anything more amusing to do. All of that is a tendency that people are thinking in the 1920s. And when we think about those feelings today of things being soaked up, we should be a little hesitant in believing they're just about to come to pass. In fact, I'd like to make a slightly stronger argument. Remember that one of the lessons of electrification is that even though there was the electric light in the 1880s and electric trolleys in the 1890s and electrification of a city at the turn of the century, it was still true that it took several more decades before electrification managed to reach all the homes and factories of this country. And it really doesn't happen until the 1920s. When you have a true transforming technology like electricity or like the car, the impact of that technology is going to take place over decades, not in a few years. Now, in modern terms, our transforming technologies are clearly things like computer-based technologies, information technologies. But when you think back in time, you know, not very many people had a personal computer before about 1980 or so. The invention of the semiconductor chip and the integrated circuit, we're really only a few decades away from those things. It may well be true that we have not yet reached the point for the computer industry and for our high-tech 1990s, which would be the equivalent of what the 1920s was for electrification, that we have not yet reached the point where it is really going to transform our standard of living, and that like people at the turn of the century, we're saying, boy, I can't believe how much things have changed. Isn't all this new equipment just remarkable? Haven't we really just altered the way in everyone works and does business? And it may well be that by the 21st century and by the year 2020, we may be looking back on all those feelings and thinking of how silly we were to think about it that way. I'm going to end this lecture just before the end of the 1920s. You have to imagine it's the summer of 1929. The economy's been booming for 6 years. Herbert Hoover is elected president in 1928. He's promising a chicken in every pot and two cars in every garage. In his campaign speech, he says, "We in America are closer today to the final triumph over poverty than ever before in the history of the land." As we look back on that time, we know what's coming. But remember that only a minority of people are expecting a recession. And of those who are, they think it'll be a short, sharp thing like 1907 or 1920 and 21. No one is expecting an utter collapse of the economy, but the Great Depression is right around the corner.